There's never been a better time to more effectively fine-tune your digital strategy with consideration for every digital tactic under the sun. Whether it's reaching your consumers through display, social, search, mobile, native, TV, there are far fewer barriers to entry than we've ever seen before. Once, access to certain features and formats were limited for a privileged few high spenders, but in an increasingly digital world, things have really changed. With more options and access than ever before, it can be challenging to have a good grasp of every potentially viable solution to consider. And if you're an advertiser, large or small, how can you make sure you're getting the most bang for your buck from your media investments? To address getting scrappy with digital media, we talked to an expert. Laura Parrott is a VP of Client and Media Services at Centro. She's sharpened her skills on vetting cost-effective digital strategies from a media career built at Asher Media, Centro, and Sapient Razorfish. We lean on her expertise to think of smart ways to make sure that media dollars are working smarter and harder for advertisers. This episode of Ad Tech Unfiltered on Getting Scrappy with Digital Media starts right now. Laura, I want to start off by thanking you for joining us today to have this conversation on how to get scrappy with digital media.
Thanks for having me.
So I think that we live in a world in which digital media has so much more access for brands and advertisers of all shapes and sizes. So with that in mind, how do I want to start off evaluating my objectives to ensure I'm achieving them while simultaneously rooting my plans in efficacy?
Often there is a frequency measure that's associated with achieving a certain objective. So for instance, we've seen historically inside of our client base that if we're trying to drive brand awareness, we can see lift performance at like an 8 to 10 range, where if we're trying to drive direct response, those frequency levels would be much higher. So if we're talking about ensuring efficacy and efficiency of getting that done, typically what we would have to do is size that audience first. So using syndicated research or a combination of other tools, determining what the target audience penetration is for our clients and brands, either nationally or on a local basis, and then understanding the frequency with which we would need to reach them and what the cost implications for that are. So, you know, if effectively you can't afford to achieve a certain objective on a certain scale, from there we would make and take measures to either scale things back, be more intelligent about how we flight things, seasonality we apply, and then of course that goes down to the tactical level as well. So, you know, we all know CPMs vary based on what sort of ad units you run, and they also engage with clients in different ways or with consumers in different ways based on the objectives you're trying to receive. Or achieve. So you don't run, you know, video to drive action, because people often are sitting in a space where they're there to consume some other form of content.
Sure. Yeah. With that in mind, you know, something you mentioned earlier is just figuring out what that appropriate reach and frequency should be, and that you might consult a couple different resources in order to do it. You mentioned syndicated research. Mm-hmm. So for a client who is really new to some of the strategies that you might present to them, what might you present from the offset so that the client knows something more about the audience they need to reach and why that would be the right strategy to go against?
Sure. So we're often leveraging a myriad of tools, and I think there's syndicated research that we can purchase access to based on survey and extrapolated data.
Yeah.
But we're also often leveraging any client's CRM database, any site visitation information to truly understand the types of behaviors that their target has, and also any nuances that we need to account for in planning. So I'd say it's a combination of really, you know, sitting down and doing a deep discovery with a client to understand and maybe poke some holes and ask some questions, explore options, go down certain rabbit holes probably from time to time.
Yeah.
And then taking that back to the tools that we have. We rely really heavily on GfK MRI, yeah, which is a syndicated tool that's based on survey data, but diving into sort of those demographic and psychographic nuances that help us make really intelligent media decisions. And then going back to looking at the full size and scope of that group and on what scale we can reach them with that effective frequency level.
What's the commonality with which you will ask those questions where you're going beyond the syndicated research, but asking the client for CRM or any other type of first-party data that they may have access to?
Anymore, that's a constant. I mean, especially in this day and age of personalization and customization of messaging in a programmatic space where we can activate on that data so easily, it's always going to be your best performer. So that's one of the first questions we'll ask of anybody is, do you have an accessible database that we can anonymize and activate against?
I think historically, often these conversations related to media mix will start with just thinking about media holistically. But now, with so many dollars specifically allocated to digital, we have to think about digital media mix. So when clients may be interested in, let's say, reaching out because they know that a company like Accenture has a lot of digital media expertise, but their inclination to reach out was because they saw something shiny and pretty and new that was out there that might be really expensive, how will you help ground their digital media mix in the realities of that are true to their needs?
So it is a balance for sure. We want to meet client need and sort of quench whatever thirst they're trying to explore in terms of activating any particular channel or platform format. But this happens all the time. I think especially most recently, a lot of brands are glomming onto the idea of being able to run, and I'm using air quotes, TV inventory, but doing it digitally. And there's a common misconception that this is more affordable in the digital space. Yeah. So we do a lot of educating, but also putting forward just some creative ways to achieve that with more of a blend. So in the advanced TV space, obviously we have connected devices.
Yeah.
We have the ability to activate on linear inventory in the open exchange programmatically, so digitally transact on linear inventory. And then there's also addressability, so being able to activate on a household level across the TV screen. And there is an efficiency to be gleaned from activating digitally for TV inventory, but the efficiency is in that we can target it, right, and it just minimizes that waste. So we try to bring forward solutions that allow people to test the vehicle, test the device and the efficacy of it,
yeah,
without needing to put forward the budget, especially folks that are trying to be scrappy and maybe don't have the huge budgets, to test the device and test the medium, but with a blend of other things. So a great example is leveraging someone like Hulu, for example,
sure,
who has a web product, a mobile product, and a TV app, and running sort of a mix of various price ranges, various types of units. But when they can report out on device type and we understand the efficacy of the different devices that the same content is being consumed on, yeah, potentially then it's a safer bet to invest what might be minimal ad dollars into that medium a little bit further.
Sure. Makes sense. So I wanted to switch our conversation in a little bit of a different direction and maybe even another starting point that clients are coming to the digital media space with as far as planning, which is having creative assets. What are your thoughts on building creative assets and subsequent testing of that?
Yeah, so I actually just saw an email in my inbox where we haven't even gotten to the point of identifying the markets we're going to run in yet, let alone building out the strategy. And the creative partner wants to know which assets, what sizes are due next week.
Yeah.
So there's a cart horse situation,
exactly,
often. And I think especially in a world where we're optimizing and sort of changing things in real time, you can't ever anticipate all the needs you're going to have. So I would say where I've seen success here is when, again, going back to especially, I know we're focusing on these scrappy sort of budget limited partners and advertisers and how to help them do that efficiently. Where I've seen success is when they invest in just really brilliant imagery. And from there, our team, any partner really, has the capability to help create version, concept ways to apply that beautiful imagery by applying copy and, you know, resizing and animating and things of that nature. But as long as you fundamentally have that sort of consistency in the visual that you're putting forward in, you know, the visually applicable spaces, I'd say that's the most important. And then, like I mentioned, I just recommend everybody lean into partners, because we all know performance is so contingent upon good creative that it's only in every publisher or vendor's best interest to be sure your creative is going to perform. And for that reason, most of us in the space have an in-house team who can help with that and are more than willing to do so, often at no cost. If a cost does apply, it's typically very minimal.
It makes a lot of sense, right? Starting with those baseline assets that could have universal application in various mediums or across various different spaces. But do you find that it's often something you need to caveat at the get-go because otherwise they may not be made available to you? Or do you think it's the norm that more people realize that there is this intention to use it in multiple spaces, or there could be that intention, so they're more prepared with creating that kind of baseline asset?
Yeah, so I think it's important to ask the questions up front and be sure we understand what type of, I'll call it, talent is being used, because there are licensing fees associated with use of stock photography or with, you know, celebrity talent and things of that nature. So you do need to be prepared for the cost implications of creating too many different versions of something that you're just licensing.
That's true, yeah.
So we do, you know, have that conversation up front and try to give people sort of boundaries around, we might need things like this to you know, achieve the correct amount of versions for the campaign we have in mind. But again, it's sort of like a crystal ball situation where we don't know what the future is going to hold given the ability we have to optimize things so frequently throughout the course of the campaign now.
Absolutely. And I think that to speak to one particular type of media that has become wildly popular, and you spoke to it a little bit earlier, is video in particular. So now that there's this popularization of consuming so much video content on your phone and not necessarily in the traditional capacity, sometimes consuming it in a vertical format, 6-second video clips, which really, you know, it's a really specific cut of what might have been a much larger recording. Are there things that you find that creative shops are considering from the get-go to align with those media possibilities? Or is that, again, something that you're often advising on?
I would say it depends on what type of partners we're working with. Obviously, we work across the spectrum of, you know, creative-only shops, media-only shops, some brands directly. And I think based on your audience, you know whether or not to sort of tip people off to that. I would say, especially in the digital space, creative and production agencies are well aware of the necessity of a vertical format.
Sure.
I think that the 6-second format is still relatively new. Clients still seem surprised and sort of overwhelmed by the idea of producing something effective in 6 seconds. But, you know, we've been able to put forward with the help of our partners at YouTube and elsewhere that it is truly effective if you can produce, you know, according to their best practices. And then I think in general, the trades have done us a favor over the years of just sort of making it very clear that anymore you can't just repurpose a TV asset and run it digitally. The audience, their sort of position in terms of how they're consuming it, everything is very different. So being really mindful of that's important.
Yeah, very fair. So I wanted to pivot the conversation again about another touch point that we often may want to consider before planning and buying a digital media plan or activating a programmatic media campaign is consideration for first-party audience data, or frankly, second or third. So I wanted to get some of your thoughts there as far as leaning into those different data types in order to better achieve campaign objectives.
Yeah, so we touched on this a little earlier, but I think first and foremost, nothing is going to perform as well as a brand's first-party data.
Certainly.
Knowing who your customer is allows us to speak to them directly based on their preferences and how they've interacted with you. But it also enables the capability to create what we call lookalikes and go find similar folks out in the, you know, internet and the webosphere to bring them into the conversation as well. So I would say priority is activating on that, or if you don't have, you know, the appropriate infrastructure and data warehouse to sort of course, legally collect that and segment it, making the investment to do that. I will say I've been a part of these initiatives with large brands, and it is a multi-year, very expensive endeavor. So I think it takes budgeting and it takes planning. But if we go back to how we help, you know, a budget challenged or super scrappy brand just sort of get started, there's certainly value in second and third party data. Often publishers or other, you know, second party partners will put forward very niche, very targeted segments that we can activate on, and it makes a lot of sense where it makes sense. Third party, I think, is sort of the impetus of digital targeting. It's where it all started. I think there's value in it. We still see it perform, but where I would caution, especially scrappy brands, is understanding the cost implications of layering that onto a programmatic bid.
Right.
Because anymore, it's becoming more and more challenging to achieve the same levels of return on investment when you're adding that on. And with the way that machine learning and algorithmic optimizations work now, it's almost more efficient to sort of take a what we would call prospecting approach, cast a wide net, and then let the machine tell you who's responding and optimize against that, versus sort of putting a filter on it of what we think a certain behavior or a certain content alignment would make sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is, in so many ways, the challenge of using third-party data today, right, is that there are these really good alternatives to quickly vet where you're running the media and seeing where you're getting the most efficacy, as opposed to taking these off-the-shelf third-party segments that may or may not work as well. Do you ever find that clients are just gung-ho on using third-party data, or have you found yourself being able to consult them off of using something that they've just historically used in the digital space?
I think for the most part, our brands and clients are really open to changing the way they work and trying new things. I think that's the beauty of especially the programmatic space, is it doesn't require a huge investment or a huge amount of time to prove out some of these thoughts around what would be more effective and more efficient. I think where we've had challenges is in what I'll just call like data paralysis, where some brands feel the need to layer a lot of things on top of each other to just be as precise as they possibly can be without understanding sort of the limitations that creates for scale. And then also, you know, like I mentioned earlier, the added cost implications of activating on that.
Yeah. I want to go back to something else you said a little earlier about first-party data and how often it can even be up to a multi-year experience or a multi-year investment in order to get this really sizable volume of quality data that is specific to your customer base. But in the instance that you are a client that doesn't have these massive budgets, but you understand the value, what might you suggest to one of those clients who, let's say, can't go deep into investing into building their own DMP, but want to dabble in the first party space?
Yeah, so for us, it's easy. I mean, we are able to extend our DMP capabilities to brands, and they use our pixels, and we help them gather and segment the data. Obviously, at the end of the day, we pass that over to them should the engagement end. And, you know, the client always owns their own data. But I would say, I would hope that's pretty universal. I think most agencies in the space offer a similar solution. And I would guess that most partners, at least those that sit in the programmatic space, would need a similar offering to be effective in whatever they're putting forward. So it's a step in the right direction, but I would say ultimately every brand's goal should be to build their own infrastructure, manage their own warehouse, segment their own data, because there's implications for that that go far beyond digital media activation.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing I think a lot of digital media clients that have what could be described as scrappy budgets, they may also be reflecting on the concept of PMPs or private marketplaces to secure more compelling inventory or more compelling alignments. Could you share a little bit about what or how brands might be looking to build plans with consideration for private marketplaces?
Sure. So I might have an unpopular opinion on this, but I think the real benefit to setting up a PMP and activating against it is when you have a very niche audience and you want to run on a certain set of sites, and you don't have a ton of requirements in terms of where it runs. Truthfully, setting up a PMP is a lot like negotiating a direct IO. So the benefit of it would require that you have enough scale within that PMP to make it more efficient than running a direct IO,
yeah,
and that you have the intention to use it on a fairly consistent or at least repeat basis.
Yeah.
because of the way it automates the transaction, the hope is certainly that it's more efficient than buying on a direct basis. But in some cases, if you're setting it up to run a specific type of unit or to, you know, be on such a small set of sites, it might honestly be more trouble than it's worth. So I think it's important to weigh, when you're considering that, weigh the cost and benefit of getting it set up. I think clients, for some reason, feel more comfortable with PMP and programmatic because it puts some controls around where you might possibly show up.
Sure.
But I think just understanding the brand safety measures that are in place and the filters that are in place, a lot of, you know, different DSPs will have category and site blacklists in place. Just understanding what sort of safeguards are in place might help with the comfortability. And then really consider when a PMP is truly necessary and will pay out for you.
Something you mentioned, Laura, was making sure that there's enough scale in the PMP for clients who haven't ventured into the PMP space. Is that something that they may have to worry about from the offset, that there may not be enough inventory associated with a single PMP, or that would there be other?
Yeah, there's a difference between a private marketplace and a programmatic guaranteed buy.
Okay.
So I think the point you were getting to is being sure there's enough scale and not expecting that if your PMP consists of one site, two, five, like something at a low scale, that it ensures that you're going to run in that space because it's still a biddable environment. It's just a closed auction or a private, you know, invite-only auction.
I do think that there is confusion sometimes around the thought that, well, now I have this special magical access to this more efficient inventory, when not necessarily fully appreciating the fact that it's not guaranteed. So could you share a little bit more clarification around the separating points between what is guaranteed versus what could be accessible to me through a private marketplace?
Yeah, so private marketplace is just stifling a certain segment of inventory, and often it's one to several, not one to one in terms of that deal. So you are probably in a private marketplace with several other advertisers that are bidding on that same subset of inventory. In programmatic guaranteed, it's one to one. So you're transacting programmatically, but directly with a site. So you take out some of the elements of when you buy site direct, you can negotiate big splashy, you know, custom deals and integrations and things like that. And more of that is becoming available programmatically. But historically, it's just about securing specified inventory on a specified site. And that just becomes the transaction mechanism, not necessarily, you know, a broader conceptual, programmatic, biddable, efficient play.
You mentioned it may not always be worth the hassle. What are things that I may want to look for when setting up a deal to evaluate if I am getting that efficiency or not?
Yeah, so it's like I started out with. I think where you have a niche audience and you only want to be on a certain subset of sites and you don't have a ton of concern around what units run where, it makes a lot of sense. Where you want a specific placement or you want something that's more custom, I would say the trouble with getting that set up to run programmatically, the cost and time it's going to take you to do that, unless you have, like I said, a repeat reason to utilize that, or a long-term sort of strategy around leveraging that particular partner or activating on that particular inventory, I don't think the time and energy invested in getting it set up to transact that way outweighs the efficiency with which, if it's just one or two of those, you can go do it directly, and there's still value in that. I think especially when you need a human on the other end of the transaction to help you really create something custom, there's still some validity to that. It's still an important element of digital media and how we create exciting, you know, new campaigns.
Yeah. That's fair. And I also think there is something to, you know, you get what you pay for. There isn't always a workaround, and having that understanding from the offset is going to better manage expectations when your campaigns go live.
No, I mean, the only thing I'd add is that I think in an ideal scenario, you have a blend of all these things. Like, you've got your efficiency play, you've created automation where it makes sense and benefits you and your client, but you're still applying creativity and human touch to just ensuring that you've got the most strategic and effective strategy in place.
Yeah, that's fair. That's great. Another area I wanted us to touch on in this conversation as it relates to scrappiness is the, you know, the back end after you've gone ahead and you've selected your publishers and you've established your objectives and want to understand the tracking and analytics part of this journey that I'm on. So how do I want to approach tracking and analytics when I'm on a budget?
Yeah, so I still think it's important to have third-party verified tracking. I think it's interesting. It's sort of coming back around to, I don't know when I started in this business too long ago to mention, I'd be embarrassed. But once upon a time, only like the top, you know, holding company agencies were leveraging their own ad servers and the rest of us were leaning on the Centros of the world. I'm a former client to do that for us.
Yeah.
So I do still think that third-party verification is important. That said, the accountability and transparency requirements of our industry are continuing to grow, which fundamentally is a fantastic thing.
Yeah.
The challenge is that it is very expensive to deploy the partnerships that can track things like viewability and audience verification and path to conversion and attribution. So a scrappy, you know, startup that's trying to get their name out there most likely doesn't have the funds to run an effective campaign and pay for all that stuff that's going to track it.
That's fair.
I think the good news is as publishers are having to sort of prove themselves and you know, defend themselves, let's say, in, you know, the case of some platforms who've been called into question around transparency or accuracy of how their algorithms work. A lot of tools are surfacing that are free to consumers and advertisers to use to understand where and how the media is running and being tracked. So one that we're super excited about and have been leveraging a lot, we were actually a major beta tester for Facebook's attribution tool.
Yeah.
And it's really wonderful in that for the first time we can track post impression for social because I think as everybody intuitively knows, when you work on a last touch attribution model, search is always going to get the most credit.
Yeah.
And allowing us to see the role that social plays in sort of that path to conversion is a great new thing that Facebook has surfaced for their own good, right? But we're being able to leverage it as well. And then the other benefit is their tool runs across all media. So we can apply the tracking to our search campaigns, to our display campaigns, and look holistically at how things are performing, and it's free.
Yeah.
So I think just brands and advertisers need to understand and lean into their partners to ask the questions of what kind of tracking, reporting, efficacy, you know, proof can you show me at the end of this campaign? The truth is not all of it speaks to one another. We as a team, our analytics folks are deep in the weeds of trying to figure out the best way to marry Google Campaign Manager, which is our third-party ad tracking system, and something like a Facebook attribution tool to make a cohesive story. There's nothing that solves everything.
Right. Unfortunately.
Yeah. But you know, that's why you lean into your partners. And I think the other important thing just to keep in mind is analysis paralysis is a real thing. And it's important to focus on what am I trying to track? What are my KPIs and benchmarks and objectives for this particular campaign? Because you can measure a whole lot of other things, but it's just going to confuse the issue.
Yeah.
So I think setting up sort of a tracking and measurement strategy at the onset of a campaign is super important. And then digging into what tools, ideally free tools, can we leverage to get to those answers.
As it relates to considering third-party tools, there are clearly players in the space that have been really established and they're being used by, let's say, the major holding companies where there are write-ups about those relationships in the trades. Is there ever concerns around using a freer or newer tool that you need to help the client understand why using something that's maybe more affordable is still fitting the bill for helping them meet their verification needs or their tracking needs?
Sure. No, I definitely think there is, going back to sort of that fear of running in an unknown space and not, you know, knowing your exact site list or your exact placements in a programmatic world. I think there's some comfort in contracting with one of the known, you know, verification partners, and we can certainly understand that. You know, when I speak about the Facebook attribution tool and it being free, I don't think, well, I don't know. I think Facebook has had their challenges in terms of advertiser fear and concerns this year, but I think they've done a really good job of combating that. And I think this tool is an answer to sort of squashing those fears. So I'd say in this case, there's some trust that it's legitimate, especially with the microscope that's on them as a company, that it can be trusted as a reporting tool. But certainly, I think if it's an unknown sort of resource that gets brought to the table, it doesn't always meet the need in terms of it being sort of that third-party trusted source of truth.
Another thing you brought up, Laura, was the issue associated with analysis paralysis, which I think in some ways parallels an earlier point you made about becoming hyper precise by layering so many types of data onto each other. How do you help a client not set themselves up for such a complicated and convoluted tracking system where they're hurting themselves more than they're helping themselves?
Yeah. So we, a couple of years ago, I think, you know, as the marketing funnel crumbled and the space became infinitely more complex and multi-layered, we sort of rolled out a template of based on what the tactic is and where it sits inside of our objectives, what we're going to measure and how we're going to measure it. And we go through that at the recommendation phase of just getting buy-off on, are we comfortable with, is this the appropriate KPI for this particular initiative or this particular, you know, tactic that we're going to deploy? And are you familiar with, are you comfortable with, are you bought into the third party that we're suggesting we use to track it? I think sometimes that opens up a ton more questions and further investigation, and I'll say sort of sail through that we need to do around that. But in most cases, I think just having all of that outlined and sort of established up front creates that comfortability that we can keep. And it's also a document we can reference throughout the relationship and the engagement to remind everyone, we all agreed to this up front. Let's not get off track or distracted by all of these other things. We can talk about them, and we're happy to facilitate whatever sort of investigative, you know, work or summarizing of additional data. But when we're talking about campaign performance, like, this is our true north. This is what we're sticking to.
Yeah, it's amazing how incredibly important it is to get people to tether themselves to the original and most important business objectives that a campaign is intended to assist with. Another thing that you had brought up that I wanted to touch on was just the importance of simplicity, which is that sometimes by not putting forth a system that has so many layers to it, you're both solving for price efficiency and preventing yourself from feeling that analysis paralysis. It's almost two birds with one stone.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think ideally we're building sort of a test and learn strategy where over time, as we evaluate performance, we're always looking into new ways to sort of either expand the reach or create greater engagement. So it's never a set and forget or let's just let the machines do it. But I think being very deliberate about how we roll that out, especially when we're trying not to waste dollars, is important.
I want to riff off of that for a quick second as far as knowing that digital media is very much not a set it and forget it, and there is very active management that goes into it. How does managing a programmatic media buy play into ensuring efficiencies, if that makes sense? Like, how do you optimize throughout a campaign, and what is maybe the speed or the cadence with which optimizations need to be taking place?
Yeah. So, I mean, we charge our programmatic buying team with looking at campaigns daily. I think it's important, especially when we're working with scrappier brands. We also, at the onset of any relationship, will set sort of a communication cadence around understanding what optimizations we are allowed to make without explicit written approval and what we need to sort of take to the clients for review and discussion before implementing them. So it varies with every engagement and with every campaign, but I'd say it's important to consistently be evaluating. The other thing, you know, I think programmatic media management to some degree is highly objective because it's based on the intuition of the buyer, what the decision to be made is. So I think as an organization, we also try, we've got a great programmatic solutions team who sort of centralize best practices, do a lot of coaching, trying to create consistency. We've got over 100 programmatic buyers. So how do we ensure that, you know, a brand has a consistent experience if for some reason, you know, the buy changes hands over the course of an engagement? So our effort is just to be sure all of our buyers are working from the same set of guidelines, have the same best practices, have the autonomy to use their intelligence and their experience to make strategic decisions, but do it with some consistency and inside some guardrails.
You know, this question is going to seem silly for you, but I think for folks that might be a little bit further away from the processes associated with programmatic buying, why is there still such a incredibly important human touch element to it? Why isn't the machine handling it for itself?
Yeah, I mean, the machine and the algorithms and all of that are fantastic. It makes our jobs easier. It takes some of the guesswork out of really looking at it and evaluating what's going on, but there's still such a human element to decision-making and understanding. The machine didn't have the conversation with the CMO about what's important.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can set your objectives and benchmarks inside of a system, but you don't have that human intelligence to understand, well, this is where they would want me to make this call on what the best solution is. So, you know, I definitely think if all decisions were made algorithmically, there would be no difference in using one DSP over another. And obviously, any brand who, you know, has leveraged any sort of technology understands that the human element, the human touch, is what drives that difference.
Another touch point I wanted us to explore is geography and how that can be a really important driver of reaching efficiencies. So I wanted to get your take on how we might bring clarity to the benefits of leveraging location to drive efficiencies and minimize waste.
Sure. So I think the answer is probably twofold in that if an advertiser has physical locations, brick and mortar locations, or if there is a relevancy to a particular event that takes place, we are able to geo-target, even geo-fence or triangulate reach around those particular locations, which allow us to be really efficient in terms of sort of creating a subset of a DMA or a city to target for those things. The other application, and this is a live example of something we're working with now, is we have a really fun CPG brand, a challenger brand, who's trying to create awareness of their product in a super crowded category. And they have a healthy budget, but comparatively speaking, it's the fraction of what their two key competitors are running. And so part of that conversation we had around their objective being awareness and their audience size being huge,
yeah,
from a frequency standpoint, to effectively reach everybody was going to be futile. We were going to be whispering in a really crowded space. So where we've applied a hyperlocal strategy is around understanding across all of the markets where they have distribution, which is pretty much everywhere with a few limitations, which of those markets have the best category development index. So where are people hungry for their category of product? Which of those markets have the highest population density of their target market? And which of those markets are their competitors not actively advertising in? And we've created a sort of tiered local market strategy around how we can best use their dollars in markets where we're really going to be able to drive a difference. And then ideally, we create funds by increasing sales and can spread their reach from there.
So I know we've been talking about first-party data and various ways in which it can be utilized. And, you know, in some instances, you're going to go the DMP route or you're going to use somebody else's DMP from a service perspective. But I think having an even more elementary conversation or foundational conversation, sometimes we take for granted that clients already know all the ways in which they can use their first-party data. But what might be some simplistic ways that clients should be thinking about their data and how it can be captured so that they can use it in a scrappy way?
So I think it's a pretty advanced application in terms of the infrastructure and the technology that's required to activate it. But sure. I think probably the best way to explain it and the best use of it is in understanding the importance and the expectation that consumers have today to be spoken to directly.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I go to XYZ website and I engage with a particular product And we've all seen it happen, right? You leave a particular advertiser's website and you go back into just, you know, the general space of reading your news, and suddenly that brand's in your face again and you've been followed. It's retargeting. Well, if I was looking at, I'm going to say, black boots on a website, and then that brand retargets me with a purple sweater, it's not going to be as effective as a message that's tailored to what I have raised my hand to say I'm interested in. So I think leveraging, you know, sort of collecting and segmenting site visitation into buckets where we can personalize the messaging and speak to the specified interests of someone who's engaged with our brand is always just going to be incredibly effective. It might scare people a little because there's still people out there who are like, wait, how did they know? So I'm always amused because we do, to your point, take for granted that everyone understands how this works. But I think that's the best application, and increasingly important as especially, you know, the millennial and Gen Z generations are expecting that. They want to be spoken to in a personalized way.
It's definitely something that can never be overlooked. And I think as much as site retargeting has been around and search retargeting has been around, they are really good tried and true tactics of finding an appropriate consumer at the right place in the right time. Another area of incredible importance, as it's consistently written up in the trades and just a natural area, I think, of client interest, is social media considerations. So when it comes to social activation opportunities and the fact that they are changing with such incredible regularity, you know, how do you help clients assess when new social offerings become available and understand if it does or doesn't make sense for them to look into?
Yeah, so you alluded to the fact that it's become my full-time job just to keep up with the changes that all of these platforms roll out and the units they're making available.
It's crazy.
It is. It is. But it's exciting. And I do think it, because it's so highly covered and covered in depth in the trades, and that's what we see excitement around, you know, in the media in general, we get a lot of questions about it. And I think some brands get ahead of themselves or get off strategy and want to activate these things because they want to be a part of what's exciting. So I think the important thing, again, I said this, I think, a few times now, is leaning into your partnerships and understanding what categories this was sort of built to serve. You know, Facebook, again, is a great partner in terms of when they roll things out, they always beta test it. Often you can apply to be included in beta tests. It doesn't always happen. You have to be the right fit for them, and it has to be the right fit for you. But they will say, you know, we're rolling out this great new offering that's intended for QSR. So I think just understanding, like, why it's being developed, who it's being developed for, and if it applies to your strategy is first and foremost. And then from there, I think, too, you know, some of these social platforms still have some barriers to entry and limitations in terms of how targeted or how granular we can be in these tests. So we've seen brands, you know, sink money into these, like, huge one-day splashy engagements that, gosh, if they don't work, we've just lost a significant, you know, portion of the funds we had to do other really great things. Mm-hmm. So I think understanding, you know, the category successes and failures is super important. I think leaning into the platforms that have more of that flexibility to help you test things on a smaller scale before investing really heavily. And then just staying as up to speed as you can, as possible with all the changes that are constantly going on. I think, you know, if you're a partner of ours, certainly lean into our, we have a monthly sort of newsletter of the things you need to know and might not have seen. So I rely on your partners and your agencies and your peers to make sure you know what's coming out and if it would be good use of time and money.
That's exactly what I was about to ask you as far as, like, staying ahead of the curve and there being new things that come out with regularity. What exactly are you sharing with clients so that they are staying up to speed? It sounds like you have something that you distribute.
Yeah, so our, like, national director of paid social does a wonderful job, and I'm sure her team deserves some credit here too for sort of aggregating. But she routes a monthly, I'll call it a newsletter, called the Monthly SMILE. It stands for Social Media Innovation List I don't know what the E is. She's going to kill me when she hears this. But basically,
that might just be added so that you can round out
so
the
it's
smile.
Not SNIL. No, but she routes this great list, and it's the headlines with links to the actual articles, but really just an amalgamation of everything cool that happened that month in social media, and giving people the highlights so that, you know, to the point and the impetus for the whole thing. People don't have time to read all these trades. So,
true.
We've charged our internal SME team with just being sure our internal teams and our clients are up to speed. I think we also do a good job of, I'll call it maybe like a quarterly basis, in team meetings, you know, kind of rolling out what's new and exciting, and then arming our sales team, our account teams with the materials that they need to distribute to partners that might make sense for those opportunities.
I think in so many ways you've already addressed this, but just wanting to put this out there as well, not only from a social perspective, but just across the digital landscape, you know, when clients do read anything in the trades that does seem big and flashy, and their thought process is that, well, let's go ahead and put our eggs into this basket because we're going to be the first to market. Well, we're also looking for you to tell us that it's definitely going to work. How do you approach those conversations where you know you don't have that opportunity to do a small test? And it's an all or nothing deal. How do you manage expectations there?
Yeah, I mean, again, this might be an unpopular comment. Some of my peers would say, but I say let someone else make the mistakes and let's learn from it.
Yeah.
And let's be really smart and see it prove itself, see the concept prove itself before we go put a bunch of money behind it. I think there are few brands and advertisers who have the luxury of just throwing money at something and hoping it works. And for the majority of our client base, we try to be much more conservative with that and be sure that we can deliver on the expectation because we know it will work.
I think if a client's true intention or an advertiser or marketer's intention is to truly be scrappy, then this in many cases just isn't appropriate territory because the risk is just too great and you know you have such few dollars to play with.
Yeah.
So it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Well, and I think too, like the stuff that gets put into the trades is sort of the nth degree of the cool concept, right? Oftentimes our subject matter experts can bring to the table a more conservative way to skin that cat. So if what you're attracted to is the video element of this particular unit, like here are all these other ways we can do that in a cost-effective way.
Laura, thank you so much for joining us and having really a thorough conversation about all the ways that clients can be scrappy when approaching digital media.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun.
Thanks to Laura Parrott, VP of Client and Media Services at Centro, for all the great advice on getting scrappy and achieving the greatest efficiencies for your digital media investments. So many great thoughts shared here, and frankly, there is no shortage of things to think about. Whether it's as simple as trying to achieve optimal reach and frequency, doing deep discovery on the types of audiences you want to reach, planning to actually satisfy client thirst for trying and testing new types of units, planning for creative, data considerations, PMPs, locations, you name it, the consideration set list is endless. I loved having this conversation with Laura. She's a longtime super respected colleague of mine and a consummate professional, really a glowing picture of delivering raving fan service to clients. I really appreciate her making the time during a recent trip from the Dallas office. Until next time, thanks for joining us on this episode of AdTech Unfiltered.